It's kind of hard to believe the valley would want the rain to stop, but historic flooding can have that effect on people. How do we know just how deep the floods were?
We go around doing it section by section so that we get a good representative mean velocity for each one of those sections and a good depth.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, the cleanup continues. Also, the DNC comes to town to scout out potential sites for its 2016 convention.
North Phoenix's biomedical campus is a step closer to reality.
And the We Are the Valley series continues with a man whose art led him to communities of collectors.
I heard her put her hand over the receiver and yell to someone in the back of her shop, "Sheila, look at this doll. Doesn't it look like Lee Harvey Oswald?"
Plus, a senator voluntarily gets marooned, and it'll be like rain on your wedding day.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Mesa officials say about 125 residents have visited the city's Resource Information Center since it opened Wednesday morning. Monday's storms and floods damaged as many as 250 homes in Mesa, but city spokesman Stephen Wright isn't surprised with the number of people who've come in.
We're still trying to get the word out. Some people, I think, the damage may not be as severe as they thought. But again, it's just trying to get the word out. And it's critical that we get these residents to come in and businesses, if there's damage to the building, to come in. We've got to assess and come up with an estimate of what the damage is. That's part of the requirements in trying to trigger that disaster declaration so we can get FEMA dollars available to help these people that have been impacted by that storm.
What kinds of things are you hearing from folks who are coming in? What kinds of services are they looking to get?
Well, obviously, initially it was cleaning supplies, things to help with. A lot of people were coming in saying that, you know, we need laundry supplies, we need food. So initially it was just that kind of first level type of stuff. Now I think it's shifting more to things like how do we mitigate against mold and some of the things that typically come if you've had a flood. A lot of it is really, now that we've got our food and stuff like that, how do we clean up? Because most of these people didn't have flood insurance.
Mesa spokesman Stephen Wright. He says the center will stay open at least through Monday. It's located at Fire Station 202 on Stapley, just south of 8th Avenue. That's the sound of a Price AA current meter. It looks like a yellow submarine with several spinning cups on top of it connected to a meter. The U.S. Geological Survey uses it to measure water velocity, and it's gotten a good amount of use over the past several weeks. Ken Fossum is the acting field chief for the USGS Tempe office.
We have recording sites there that take in gauge height, the height of the water, and we go out and do measurements to verify our rating. We have a rating for these sites based on what the height of the water is, so we know how much water is coming through.
How do you determine how much water is in a given pool of water or a river or a creek or something like that?
We do current meter measurements. We've got a setup that we can get out on bridges or out on an installed cableway that we have over some of these streams. Put the meter down, we're able to get a velocity in different sections across the river. And then we get a depth as well to go ahead and calculate the area in each one of those sections. Use the area, we use the velocity for each one of those, calculate the amount of discharge for each section, and then add all of those up for the full stream.
How important is the spot that you pick to do that in terms of getting an accurate reading?
We try to do the best we can to get a general, even section that we can work in. A lot of times when we're doing flood measurements, we have to do it off of a bridge or something close by where we can actually be above the stream and be able to do that. So we try to do the best we can as far as picking a section that we can actually use.
I think there's a perception that when you're trying to measure floodwaters, rain or snow, something like that, you can basically just like stick a yardstick into the ground, hit the ground, see where the precipitation comes up to, and say, okay, there's X inches or X feet. Scientifically speaking, why is that not the right way to do it?
Flow across a stream like that is not going to be the same for every point where you're going along it. You can have shallow edges, shallow points along the edges. You can have deeper parts in the center of the stream. So we go around doing it section by section so that we get a good representative mean velocity for each one of those sections and a good depth so that we can make sure we add up each one of those little pieces and get a total flow for it.
Other than just general knowledge, what do you do with the information that you get?
We use a lot of this information to provide to emergency managers so that they can use that to try and protect the public and property from floodwaters. We also use this information on our gauges so that we can set up what we call a rating. Based on the height of the water, we can say, you know, at this height, there's this much water coming through the section. So we do those measurements so that we can verify our ratings at each one of those sites.
Ken Fossum is the acting field chief for the U.S. Geological Survey's Tempe office.
Phoenix's record rainfall on Monday isn't expected to put much of a dent in the long-term drought. We'll have to wait and see what kind of snowpack winter brings. But thanks to a pair of underground storage basins, Granite Reef near Mesa, and the New River Agua Fria in the West Valley, a percentage of that precipitation can be put to future use. Krista McJunkin, who's in charge of water strategy for Salt River Project, says Arizona's been a pioneer in water banking.
This notion that we have renewable water supplies, surface water, that we can't always put fully to use when it's available. And by being able to bank it, we can save it for when we need it. SRP really led the way with building reservoirs to store water on the surface. Water banking is taking that to the next level and saying when we have renewable resources, we can recharge them under the ground. GRUSP, which is the Granite Reef Underground Storage Project, was one of the first permitted facilities. It's an underground storage facility, which basically means you are recharging water into the underground aquifers. You choose locations that are very porous, so the water doesn't stand around very long. You apply the water to specially constructed basins, and it infiltrates over a pretty short period of time. So the goal is to not lose much to evaporation.
Are there things that have changed over the course of 20 years at the Granite Reef facility? Are there things that have made it more effective?
Yeah, it's been expanded over its history. It now consists of 7 basins that can be managed depending on the amount of water that's being delivered to it. Its infrastructure has been improved so that the deliveries to the facility are more dependable and can be better monitored for measurement purposes. And it's really become a cornerstone of how water is managed in Arizona.
And what about the West Valley facility? How did that come about, and does that work the same way?
The benefit to that is recognizing that we need to have water stored in areas where it can be recovered and areas where there's existing infrastructure. So we took advantage of SRP's existing delivery infrastructure, canals and laterals, to bring the water to a new location.
We know about the importance of snowpack in the winter, but Monday, record rainfall at Sky Harbor, and certain areas got 5 and 6 inches. Does that affect groundwater storage? Does that affect any sort of water storage? Can that be used?
Certainly some of the water did infiltrate. The water that was able to be diverted into retention basins, it infiltrates into the aquifer, and certainly that's to the benefit of our water supply. Long term, though, it doesn't have much impact on the drought. Probably the biggest impact it had is decreasing demand, because everybody turned off their sprinklers because you didn't need to irrigate your lawn.
Hopefully, yes.
Hopefully that was the case. So laying off demand, and for SRP, that means we get to leave more water in our surface reservoirs up in Lake Roosevelt to save when we need it for the future.
If we could store more water, should we?
Absolutely. Water storage is a critical part of our water planning. Having the capacity to store water in locations that it's anticipated to be used in the future is a really important part of our planning. We could always use additional water storage capacity so that we can take advantage of additional supplies when they're available.
Krista McJunkin is in charge of water strategy for Salt River Project. Whether it's baseball cards or impressionist masterpieces, a shared interest in collecting can bring people together. As part of our community series, We Are the Valley, KJZZ's Nick Blumberg introduces us to a man who lives in one of his collections and dips his toe in many different communities.
My name is Paul Wilson, and I'm a professional scenic designer and scenic painter. But on my own, I sort of take my work home with me, and I live in the 1950s.
Wilson isn't kidding. His living room could be in a museum.
This would have been like the high fashion of, say, the late 50s, but it's all from Sears. It represents trying to be the utmost in modern.
Wilson started collecting at thrift stores in the 1980s when nobody else really cared about mid-century. Now scores of people would love his free-form tables, funky abstract wall art, low fabric couches, mostly in turquoise, red, and gold. The shelves in his kitchen are full of vintage food products like Cheddo Bit.
Pasteurized processed cheese food. and you were supposed to make grilled cheese sandwiches and such with it.
Canned chicken soup.
And it's still in there.
Over the years, Wilson's made friends with other people who have authentic period homes and share his passion for a lifestyle that's a half century old.
They might go more the 60s Danish modern route, but we all appreciate each other's stuff. It's like, where did you get that ice bucket? Or I'll say, where did you get that turquoise range?
But finding people who share some of Wilson's other interests is less common.
I'd like to think that I'm probably the only person in Arizona, or maybe the United States, that has a collection of tasteful Lee Harvey Oswald dolls.
Wilson got interested in Oswald not for shock value, but for artistic value. He's created dozens of alternative lives for Oswald and created the Wee Lees to match. Many of the mini Oswalds are modified Ken dolls, so driven by his art, Wilson's dabbled in the incredibly detail-oriented world of Barbie and Ken collecting.
Some of my friends were like, seriously, you're paying $25 for a little tiny razor for a Ken doll from 1962, I'd say, yep, Lee needs a razor.
So whether it's a razor for Lee or a plastic Melmac plate to fill his china cabinet, Wilson finds his way into all sorts of oddball collector communities with varied interests but a similar passion.
A lot of it is community in that we're sharing information. And that's what I like, because you make friends, you learn things, and you just have fun with it. It's fun kind of living in a fantasy world.
Nick Blumberg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
If you want to see pictures of Paul Wilson's Out of This Era house, go to kjzz.org. And if you're part of a community to which you feel connected, tell us by writing to wearethevalley@kjzz.org. Still to come, can the Frank Lloyd Wright School of Architecture in Scottsdale stay relevant without a master's program?
The Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation was to be there to see that the Taliesin Fellowship survived. It was to help it, and it's done just the opposite.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Your weekend getting off to a pretty fast start if you're on the Valley freeways at this hour. A couple of exceptions. There's an accident I-17 southbound at Thomas. Also a collision I-10 westbound at 7th Street. That's blocking the off-ramp. Valley weather for tonight. We're expecting mostly clear skies and lows should be around 80. And then for this weekend, slight chance of rain returns to the forecast with highs both Saturday and Sunday of around 101. It's currently mostly sunny, 102 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by the University of Arizona Eller MBA, with two programs for working professionals in downtown Phoenix and a 100% online option. Details on a Thursday, September 18th info session at ellermba.com.
When President Obama decided to delay any executive action on immigration reform, observers cited concerns from some Democrats who were worried about voter backlash in November. But how will that decision impact Latino voting? For answers, we turn to Mark Hugo Lopez. He's the director of Hispanic research at the Pew Research Center.
One of the things that folks were concerned about was motivation of Latinos to vote in this upcoming election. Were they going to be mobilized or not? And if the president had engaged in executive decision, there was some interest that perhaps that might actually motivate some Latino voters to turn out who may not have otherwise have turned out to vote. But many of the Senate races where if you take a look at those that are toss-up states today, you'll find that in many of those places, Latinos make up less than 5% of the eligible voter pool there or the electorate. But in Colorado, the one exception, they make up about 14%. So in total, a relatively small presence in many of these states that may be toss-ups in the Senate.
Where does immigration fall on the list of reasons why Latinos show up to vote?
Well, it's one of the more important reasons why they show up to vote. I think it depends on the election that one might want to look at. But in some elections, it's been a key motivator or an important motivator. In others, it's been one of many motivators. And with the recession, for example, in 2008 and in 2012, with the recovery being slow, economy and jobs is oftentimes pointed to as a more important motivating factor for turning out to vote.
Do you think that the president's decision might have sort of the inverse effect, that since immigration is not on the docket, at least right now, that Latinos might not bother to vote?
Well, that's a very good question. That's something I think that remains to be seen. But I think historically, looking at the Latino vote, particularly in midterm elections, voter turnout rates were already low. What would happen this year? You know, one is uncertain about exactly how turnout will go until the election actually happens. But in 2006 and in 2002, Latino voter turnout rates were also on the order of about 31-32%. So that compares with about a turnout rate of 48% for whites in, say, 2010. So voter participation in midterms generally falls off, and for Latinos it falls off somewhat more than it does for other groups.
Here in Arizona and probably elsewhere, we've been hearing for a very long time about the potential power of Latino voters, and it hasn't really come to fruition yet here. What do you think it will take for Latino voters to sort of realize that potential?
Well, I think a couple of stats first that I think are important to note. So today there's about 25 million Latinos who are at least 18 years of age and a U.S. citizen. That means they can register. That means that they can vote. But what we've seen in elections, even in years that were important years where the Latino vote reached record turnout levels, like 2012, for example, oftentimes only about half and sometimes even fewer than half of Latinos turn out to vote. Now, that means that there's a lot of potential still with the Latino vote, even with the numbers of Latinos who are currently eligible to vote. But whether or not it will materialize and make a bigger impact, I think, depends on a lot of things. It depends on the dynamics of a particular election. On top of that, many Latinos, many who are helping to raise that number of potential voters, they're oftentimes young people who are coming of age. And that means they're first-time voters who need to figure out where to register, need to figure out where to vote. And many of the same challenges that face other young people for voter participation also face young Latinos. So I think there's a number of reasons why we haven't quite seen the Latino electorate quite materialize the way some might have expected, given its relative size. Nonetheless, that population is growing, and that's going to have an impact on future elections because each election cycle, we see more Latinos than ever eligible to vote.
Mark Hugo Lopez is the Director of Hispanic Research at the Pew Research Center. Officials with the Democratic National Committee were in Phoenix this week. The city is a finalist to host the party's 2016 National Convention. Members of the DNC's Technical Advisory Committee came to town to check out its facilities, including hotels, the Convention Center, and Chase Field. Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton says this week's meetings mainly dealt with logistics.
They really want to see our light rail system. They want to see our Convention Center, Chase Field, U.S. Airways Arena. Many of the hotels in the region, a convention of this size and magnitude, they want to make sure that Phoenix is truly ready to host an event like this. And I think they came away very impressed that we are ready.
What do you tell them to try to convince them that, yes, these facilities are here, this is how they work, this is how the light rail system works, for example?
Well, I think they want to, when I tell them, I really want to make sure they know that they'll have an enthusiastic supporter and collaborator in myself, my team at the city, the business community here, the community as a whole, the nonprofit community, our labor groups. You know, we're all on board to make sure that this convention, if they choose Phoenix, is the most successful convention in history. And obviously, it's a very important historical event. There's a really good chance that they'll nominate the first female to be the presidential candidate in history. And they need to know that not only are we logistically ready, but we are fired up and we are passionate about our desire to get this convention and be willing to help. And I think they came across loud and clear that we are ready from a logistical perspective, and we're really excited about this opportunity, ready to roll up our sleeves and make this thing hugely successful.
Did you learn anything from going through this process with the RNC earlier in the year that helped sort of get you ready to talk to the Democratic folks?
Well, look, sure. I mean, we had to convince the DNC folks that the time of year, which is these conventions occur during the summer, will not be a significant detriment to the success of the convention. That was one of the issues, unfortunately, when the RNC decided not to come to Phoenix, that they were concerned about.
Do you think that 5, 7, 10 years ago, Phoenix would have been able to even be a finalist for something like this?
No. And the reason is we didn't have the facilities. We've made an investment in the heart of our city. The people of the city have made an investment in downtown that now it allows us to be even in the ball game, if you will, even in consideration for events of this size, magnitudes, and import.
If the DNC picks Phoenix for its convention, what would the city have to do to really be ready for all those folks to come?
Well, we need to make sure that delegates from all over the country and all over the world, frankly, delegates abroad, they'll be coming to Phoenix. We need to make sure that they have a great hotel experience within a reasonable distance of downtown, that they have transportation from those hotels to the downtown area. We have the best security possible so that the delegates will have not only a great experience inside the arenas, but feel as safe as possible and be as safe as possible. And we need to make sure that the experience from the airport to downtown or wherever these people's hotels are going to be is as easy and efficient as possible.
Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton. He says the DNC expects to make a decision by the end of this year or the beginning of next year. Phoenix is competing against New York, Philadelphia, Birmingham, and Columbus, Ohio.
Republican Arizona Senator Jeff Flake spent 6 days and nights on a remote desert island. He had no food, no water, and hardly any tools to survive. Instead, he had a Democratic senator by his side. As KJZZ's Stina Sieg explains, it was all for an upcoming reality TV special meant to send a message to Congress and the public.
You might recognize that dramatic tune as the opening credits to the TV show Survivor. Yeah, the Discovery Channel's Rival Survival, starring Flake and Democratic New Mexico Senator Martin Heinrich, is kind of like that. But don't expect anyone to get voted off the island. Instead, this one-time TV special is all about working together. Flake says he and Heinrich came up with the concept to prove a point.
We thought that maybe if a Republican and a Democratic senator could survive on a desert isle, then maybe our colleagues could reach across the aisle.
And it should be mentioned that Flake's Isle had no water sources and was surrounded by a shark refuge. The senators brought nothing but the clothes on their backs and 3 survival items between them. Senator Heinrich is honest. At first,
I thought the idea was a little crazy.
But the more he thought about it, the more he decided something as strange as this might actually help Congress work better, work together.
And I think humanizing an institution that has gotten far too partisan and is very frustrating for people on the inside and the outside right now was important as well.
But will it make good TV?
My first reaction to it was, this sounds like a dumb idea. But my second reaction to it was, I've heard dumber.
That's NPR's Linda Holmes. She's the editor of the pop culture blog Monkey See and host of the podcast Pop Culture Happy Hour. She says it's unprecedented to have a show like this featuring 2 politicians, let alone sitting U.S. senators. But she thinks the success of Rival Survival may hinge on the same thing all reality shows do. Whether or not its stars allow themselves to drop their guard.
I think that people with active political careers are probably among the most difficult to put in a state of being unguarded.
And speaking of which, that brings us to a big question, one that might not be covered on camera. On a desert island with no water, what did the senators drink? As a few media outlets have already asked, was it their own urine? Flake is emphatic.
No, absolutely not.
Rival Survival premieres October 29th. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Frank Lloyd Wright School of Architecture in Scottsdale could be graduating its last group of students. As KJZZ's business correspondent Christina Hansen reports, the school is losing its accreditation in 2017, and Frank Lloyd Wright's grandson has something to say about that.
2 years ago, the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation was told that if it didn't spin off its architecture school into a separate legal entity, the school wouldn't be able to offer master's degrees after 2017. This summer, the foundation ultimately decided to go with the latter, which means the school, as we've always known it, will come to an end. It's impossible to know what Frank Lloyd Wright himself would have to say about all of this, but his grandson, Eric Lloyd Wright, has an idea. Wright's 84 and still a practicing architect in Malibu, and he says his grandfather was a maverick and wouldn't have wanted his school to be accredited in the first place.
He never thought much of college. He didn't think he really got a good education through an academic school. He felt you learn by doing.
During Frank Lloyd Wright's lifetime, you didn't need a degree to be an architect. But the world has changed since his death 55 years ago. College is now an expectation, and like many professions today, a degree is required to get an architect license. That's why the Wright School became accredited in 1992, and without it, Eric Wright says the school can't go on in the way his grandfather would have wanted.
If you lose that, you lose the concept of what my grandfather was trying to achieve.
KJZZ obtained a copy of Wright's will from 1958. In it, Wright explains that he established the foundation as an outgrowth of the Taliesin Fellowship, which is now called the Wright School. Together, the foundation and the fellowship operate as a college.
The Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation was to be there to see that the Taliesin Fellowship survived. It was to help it, and it's done just the opposite.
But the foundation says the school isn't going away. It's just changing. It'll offer post-professional training and maybe still offer degrees through a partnership with an accredited university. But Eric Wright says his grandfather would be disappointed either way. Christina Hansen, KJZZ News.
Since 2010, there have been more than two dozen reported violent clashes with U.S. Customs and Border Patrol agents and 40 fatalities since 2005, and to date, no one has been reprimanded.
Gil Kerlikowske took over as head of U.S. Customs and Border Protection back in March of this year, and he told NPR's Morning Edition that he is playing catch-up, trying to bring transparency to the agency.
I can promise you on these cases involving force and the reviews that are going on that we will be following through and that I'll be examining these with a group of people here in CBP, leadership within the Border Patrol and others, that are just as absolutely concerned as I am at getting things resolved, at being more open to the public and the people we serve about what our actions are. But I would also tell you that this is built up over quite a bit of time, and it's going to take a little time to resolve it.
Andrew Becker of the Center for Investigative Reporting published a report this week on these border issues and talks with the Takeaway's John Hockenberry about why it may be nearly impossible to get a good picture of exactly what's happening.
Part of the issue with many of these incidents is that there really isn't very good data that's available to the public. We had submitted a Freedom of Information Act request to the Customs and Border Protection. And after some wrangling back and forth, we finally managed to get about 11,000 pages of use of force documents. The Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection are required to submit or fill out paperwork within an hour or a couple hours of one of these shootings. There were huge holes in the data. There was an entire year's worth of information that was just missing.
In those 11,000 pages, those are all reports of violent incidents, each one of them?
Yeah, it's any time that there's any kind of use of force, from non-lethal use of force, and that's laying hands on a person. From there, it may be using a collapsible baton, a taser, and then ultimately the use of lethal force.
Is there a particular incident that speaks to a militarization of the culture of the Border Patrol or the difficulty that they may be having in filling the slots since Congress has really ramped up the number of Border Patrol agents and the training of them has been a problem, and that's even been mentioned on Capitol Hill?
Well, a big part of this, and whether it is militarization or just the emphasis on greater border security, is this idea of the need to have the border totally secure before the country can move ahead or Congress can move ahead with any kind of immigration reform. And part of that has been hiring a significant number of new agents. The Border Patrol has doubled in size in roughly a decade, historic growth, unprecedented growth. And with that, and in the rush to hire these people to meet congressional mandates and other political pressure, there is concern within that agency that they hired on too quickly. And in many cases, they didn't properly vet all the people they hired. And so there's some concern that there may be either some problems with suitability, whether people are fit to carry a gun and have a badge, but also concerns about the amount of training they're getting and what they're training both at the academy and also out in the field. So with that in mind, we've recently been looking at a number of these shooting incidents, but have really focused in on one that took place in 2010 in Eagle Pass, Texas. It involved a young agent, 26 years old, who'd only been on the job for a couple of years. And he got into a violent confrontation with an 18-year-old named Juan Mendez, high school dropout, had a bit of a criminal past, mostly as a minor, who was trying to smuggle marijuana or facilitate marijuana smuggling from Mexico into the United States. This 26-year-old agent, his name is Taylor Poitevant, basically chased this 18-year-old down, who was in a pickup truck with his 15-year-old cousin. The two teens got out, tried to run away, but the agent caught the 18-year-old, Juan Mendez. And they, over a course of a few minutes, exchanged a number of blows. Juan Mendez hit Taylor Poitevant in the head pretty hard, according to witnesses, in an effort, again, according to witnesses, to get away. Juan Mendez was about 15 feet away after hitting Taylor Poitevant in the head when Poitevant pulled out his weapon and shot Juan Mendez twice, hitting him in the back and the side. And in the minds of many people, that has been something of an emblematic incident, in that it was a young agent with not much experience getting into a situation that rapidly escalated to a point that lethal force was used. And there are serious questions about whether or not that use of force was appropriate.
What are the rules of engagement when someone is trying to escape and the officer has a firearm?
Really, it comes down to this. An agent is typically found to be justified in using lethal force if he can articulate a reasonable fear for his safety or for somebody else's safety, whether that's his partner or a member of the public. And so in this particular incident, based on some of the investigative work that the Texas Rangers had done, basically found that this individual had a fear that was reasonable, and therefore prosecuting him for a civil rights violation or an excessive use of force was not necessary, was not appropriate.
Basically, they were balancing the hit on the head against the prohibition of using a weapon to prevent someone's escape. You're not really allowed to shoot someone who's trying to escape, but if they do hit you in the head, you're allowed to retaliate. In this case, that's the gray area.
It is, and it really varies. I mean, from agency to agency, even from the state, local, to the federal, from, say, the FBI's perspective and their policy, that if someone is posing a threat to an agent and they may be trying to gain a more strategic position and they could be running away, that would not necessarily be an inappropriate use of force or lethal force for an FBI agent to fire on that person. Other local law enforcement agencies don't have that kind of a policy. And so there is a situation where there are a number of people that believe in law enforcement, that believe that this was a questionable shooting, and yet there really is no resolution here.
Andrew Becker, reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
The level of diversity in Phoenix is growing, and so has the need for interpreters to assist the public.
This person isn't calling 911 because they are looking for the latest bus schedule. They're calling for the most important service that they'll probably ever call for.
That's ahead. It's The Show.
Good afternoon. He's Steve. I'm Mark. Some valley traffic to be aware of if you're heading out of the office early on this Friday. An accident I-10 westbound on the 7th Street exit ramp blocking traffic there. Also in that area, 51 southbound, an accident at McDowell. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the day today with a high of 104. Clear tonight, overnight lows near 80. Partly sunny skies, slight chance of rain tomorrow and Sunday with highs each day of 102. That is our current temperature, 102 at 239.
KJZZ is supported by DannyZalescoPresents.com. Singer and pianist Diana Krall comes to the Orpheum Theater November 7th to kick off her tour promoting her soon-to-be-released album, Wallflower. Diana Krall tickets are now on sale.
On Thursday, a state panel chaired by Governor Jan Brewer approved a swap of state trust land in North Phoenix that she expects to be one of the final steps in creating the Arizona Biomedical Corridor. A biosciences cluster already has a presence near downtown Phoenix. The northern corridor would stretch from 56th Street, south of the Loop 101 freeway, to Tatum and the 101. Joan Kerber-Walker, president and CEO of the Arizona Bioindustry Association, says the latest development is another sign of the industry's growing footprint here.
This is the longest-running statewide bioscience economic development project in the United States. And the results of that have been very, very positive, including the fact that during the recession, when, as you know, our state was hit very, very hard, the biosciences continued to grow companies and grow jobs. But to continue to fuel industry growth, you need to continue to have the resources, the places for the people to do the work.
How does competition work when it comes to a field that, yes, is about helping the economy, but also about helping people going forward?
When we look at the growth that we've had in Arizona, it has been highly collaborative. And when we talk about expanding assets, so building or expanding upon actually what we already have on the Northern Corridor, what we're really looking at is getting to what we call critical mass. When you have the right number of companies, the right number of employers and employees, as well as the right number of research assets, like the universities and the medical schools, that allow you to continue to grow, you know, on top of each other. In the life sciences, as compared to some other industries where, you know, it's a very dog-eat-dog situation, these companies have to work together. Whether it's a drug company with a hospital with a clinical trials organization, or all of those commercial entities and private entities with government agencies like the FDA.
Whether it is an institute of higher learning or it is an up-and-coming business or a research facility, why is it so important for them to be in close proximity to each other?
If you think about traditional manufacturing, you walked down the hallway and you talked to the guy that had the answer to the question. In the life sciences, we're dealing with huge questions. And no single organization would have all of the answers. So by co-locating companies within these corridors, you get greater collaboration, and greater collaboration leads to greater success. So if we look at other parts of the country where this is a proven model, good examples are the Research Triangle in North Carolina, the areas around MIT and Harvard in Boston, and, of course, the area around UC San Diego and Scripps in Southern California. In all of those cases, what you saw was corridors develop that had combinations of research, clinical, and companies working together, developing new innovations, and working side by side. And that's how innovation moves forward faster.
Joan Kerber-Walker, president and CEO of the Arizona Bioindustry Association. Next Monday marks the start of Arizona Bioscience Week. The Maricopa Association of Governments, or MAG, this week released its recommendations for improving transportation in Carefree and Cave Creek. The plan does not include public transit. Instead, it focuses on things like bike lanes, sidewalks, and parking. Eileen Yazzie is the project manager for MAG on this study.
It was really two towns in this area kind of uniting and saying, can you help us plan for the future? And the future could be the short term between 5 and 10 years, as well as with long term 20 years or 25 or 30 years. We started this and are ending this as a transportation framework, almost as a playbook of how things can look and change in the future.
Yazzie says planners took input from town residents and people who visited for special events and took care not to urbanize the small towns. She says the plans look to enhance the communities, not take away their special elements.
Let's make sure that the street is more safe for all the users, looking to have that separated sidewalk, doing the bike lanes, as well as kind of almost a colored buffer, and make sure that, you know, it handles traffic and as well as with special events. And over in Carefree, it's the same exact thing.
To get more of a sense of some of the ideas the towns are considering, Ian Cordwell drove me around the area. He's Cave Creek's planning director and says the project is a chance for the two towns to work together. He says bicyclists, pedestrians, hikers, drivers, motorcyclists, and equestrians all use the town's roads, and the recommendation should make them safer.
The challenge is using the existing right-of-way that we have between the two towns and to work within that. Currently, there are two lanes in both directions through Cave Creek Road, which ties the two towns together. We're trying to get people through town safely. They're here now. The bicyclists, the pedestrians, the equestrians, they're all here, but we want to keep them separated from the vehicular and motorcycle travel as well.
What kind of economic development do you think this project might lead to in your town?
Well, I think if we're able to provide safe access for people coming through, I know people say that, well, bicyclists are going to stop for water and then be on their way. But if they're welcomed into the community, into the businesses, I believe they're going to come back with their visitors and families to the valley and say, wow, we discovered this cool community with natural beauty and carefree in Cave Creek. And so the economics is going to develop as the businesses see more people able to come safely.
When you talk about using the right-of-way, the infrastructure that's already in place, presumably that means narrowing some lanes of traffic. Is there any concern about that causing more traffic problems in the town?
Actually, narrowing lanes would be a good traffic calming effect. So it actually helps people to slow down, and it does help business to slow down and stop and see the signs and see the businesses instead of just speeding through on their way to someplace else.
How much demand do you think there is in Carefree and Cave Creek for these kinds of plans? I mean, you think about, at least from the outside, these two towns, and they kind of epitomize the car culture. You sort of drive everywhere you go. You don't really see sidewalks. Do residents of these towns want this stuff?
I believe they do. We've had a lot of public input. We've had several meetings with both towns in different places. And I think what's been interesting is the input we've gotten from the residents themselves. People are here now, hiking and walking, and people are biking here through the towns and within the towns. They're coming now, and we need to plan for it.
Other parts of the valley have done similar kinds of things as far as bike lanes and sidewalks and different streetscaping, things like that. I would imagine that you don't want to look like, say, Central Phoenix when this project is complete up here.
With all due respect to Phoenix, it's a different character in the city. We do embrace some things like mixed use and walkability. We want to do those things and still keep the two towns looking as they do. So the effort is going to be to have the bike lanes blend in to the existing paths of travel, but marked, delineated so the bicyclists are safe, and to have the pedestrians able to walk safely past businesses and outside of parking areas. Those walking areas may be different across each property. Every solution is going to be different as we move through the towns.
Ian Cordwell is Cave Creek's planning director. It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Dennis Medlin. I'm out here with the Palm Squad. We're getting ready to trim this palm tree today. Every tree is different. Yeah, it's real easy to get hurt, but you know, we're good so we don't make mistakes. There's no room for mistakes in this business. You know, it takes a really good crew to actually be able to do this, and I'm glad that I have a really good crew. It's just something you just can't jump into. You have to practice for years to be able to, you know, overcome the fear of the height and different types of trees and environment.
That's Dennis Medlin trimming palm trees in Mesa. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just like saying the word palm frond, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. The expanding diversity in the Valley is not limited to people who speak Spanish as a first language. Far from it. Based on figures from the Phoenix Union High School District, there are at least 50 different languages students hear or use at home. Phoenix Councilman Daniel Valenzuela, who represents the 5th District, says the city's diversity is a plus, but improving communication is a work in progress.
The question is, how do we move from
having a diverse community to having one that is truly an inclusive community? How do we have people in our community who feel like they are part of this community?
To what extent are the wheels in motion for the city to hire more interpreters?
Just like anything else, it starts with a conversation. There would be costs involved. We do have some nonprofits that we continue to work with out of this council office, and I'm sure other council offices are probably doing the same thing. And we will continue to look for, out of this office, we'll continue to do some research and look for grant opportunities.
How has your background as a firefighter affected your interest in this topic?
That does play a factor. When you arrive to someone's home and the person that you're there to help cannot communicate with you effectively and efficiently and vice versa, and it's not because they can't speak, you know, English, because they only speak Spanish. I think a lot of times here in Phoenix, people assume that that's always the case. You know, how can we help this person? This person isn't calling 911 because they are looking for the latest bus schedule. They're calling for, at this particular time, the most important service that they'll probably ever call for.
Phoenix Councilman Daniel Valenzuela. One of the nonprofits assisting with interpreters for refugees is the International Rescue Committee. Nikki Walker works for the organization's Phoenix branch.
On average, over 7,000 immigrants, refugees in particular, are being resettled here into the Phoenix area. And most of them don't speak Spanish, the traditional language that we're used to hearing in Phoenix. Most of them speak languages of lesser diffusion. Many are coming from Burma, from Bhutan, from Somalia, Iraq. So very diverse countries with very diverse languages.
The International Rescue Committee has more than 100 contract interpreters. In a place growing like this one is, how many more are needed?
Well, I think that's a question for, you know, both public and private institutions as well as the nonprofits involved in, you know, in helping immigrants to come together around this issue, to reach consensus that this is a critical problem and a critical gap in our community. I think as a community, we have to make the decision that some investment is going to be required and that it's an investment that's going to, you know, turn out very positively, because ultimately we will have a more integrated community.
Is there an almost universal recognition by the folks who come to the Valley and don't speak English or Spanish, that they need to learn that as quickly as possible? And how daunting does that feel to many?
One of the first things that we do as resettlement agencies is provide a cultural orientation. Actually, that happens even before refugees arrive in particular. You know, they're given an orientation abroad before they agree to be resettled, or they choose to be resettled, that, you know, learning the language is going to be critical to their survival and their success in integration. And we partner with several agencies to be able to provide that language training. And, you know, people are very, very open and very willing, not only because, you know, based on being here and their experience, they realize, gosh, this is a really critical step for my integration, is learning the language. But, you know, it's also something that's very empowering.
I presume this is only going to be more needed as the years go by.
Absolutely. I'll give you a specific case in the IRC situation. You know, we've heard that we're going to have an influx of Congolese refugees in the next year or so, and that's a population that we have not been seeing coming into the Valley. So as an agency, you know, we are taking steps to prepare for that population and their particular needs, because the needs of each population is going to be different. You know, we're going to be training our, you know, some Congolese interpreters based on the Congolese community that we find here to prepare for those types of situations.
Nikki Walker of the International Rescue Committee's Phoenix branch.
More than a century ago, people came to the hot, dry Phoenix climate to recover from all sorts of pulmonary ailments, tuberculosis, for instance. Today, one of the places that was popular back then became a town of its own. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us more about it.
Drive east on Dunlap Avenue from 7th Avenue, and you'll notice S Mountain, the marker showcasing it's the community of Sunny Slope. The area was first settled in the 1890s by prospectors and homesteaders. Did you know Sunny Slope was also an area where people who were very ill came to try to recuperate?
People who had tuberculosis, they came here from the East Coast, they came from the Midwest.
Reba Grandrud is a historian who's written a book about Sunny Slope.
The poor people who had no money and no way to make a living and couldn't do anything else were just out here.
As we sit at the North Mountain Visitor Center, Grandrud describes how the community once looked. Sunny Slope was small, roughly bordered by the North Mountain Range on the north end, the Arizona Canal to the south, and from 7th Avenue to 12th Street. Newcomers set up tents and makeshift homes in the area. By 1911, California architect William Norton created a subdivision in the area, and it was his daughter who came up with the name Sunny Slope after admiring the sunshine glimmering on a slope. Sunny Slope soon gained a reputation where contagiously ill and poor people lived.
In the 19-teens and 20s, they're mostly working families, homesteading families, and destitute families.
As the community began to grow, so did the needs of its residents. Two local women became the caretakers for the ill. They also regularly provided humanitarian aid for the poor. Through their efforts, the organization Desert Mission was founded. The faith-based facility expanded through the 1950s. Because of a greater demand for its medical services, a new center was created, today known as the John C. Lincoln Health Network. It was named after Ohio business owner John Cromwell Lincoln. The inventor brought his wife to the valley to recover from tuberculosis, who, by the way, lived past 100. Lincoln became a major contributor of Desert Mission and its expansions.
Through the years, John C. Lincoln Hospital was the major employer and caused Sunny Slope to become what we know of today.
Grandrud says Sunny Slope was an isolated area for decades, and voters did try to incorporate it. After four failed attempts, Phoenix annexed the area in 1959. But Grandrud says if you ask someone who has been here since the beginning, they're more likely to tell you they're from Sunny Slope than from Phoenix. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you know things that we ought to know, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
The Phoenix Mercury has continued its dominance in the WNBA Finals. The Mercury won Game 1 of their best-of-five series against the Chicago Sky by 21 points. Game 2 was even more of a laugher as the margin of victory was 29 points. Phoenix writer and Mercury fanatic Nikki D'Andrea says the team is on a historic roll.
The Phoenix Mercury aren't just seeking their third WNBA championship. They are on an unending quest for perfection that has elevated their play to record-shattering levels. But what makes the Mercury so good is that they think they're never good enough. They smoked the Chicago Sky in Game 1, winning by 21 points and setting a record for highest shooting percentage in a finals game. But after the game, the first thing Diana Taurasi mentioned was the number of Mercury turnovers, and Brittany Griner criticized herself for making fouls. Coach Sandy Brondello expressed disappointment that the team played really well for only 30 minutes instead of 40. Even when the Mercury are up by 20 points in the fourth quarter, she's screaming from the sidelines like the game is still at stake. That perfectionist work ethic emanates from Diana Taurasi, widely considered the best basketball player on the planet. Kobe Bryant calls her the White Mamba. She does things on the court that make you go, whoa. She hits buzzer beaters from half court. She sinks three-point shots all day long. She makes precise cross-court passes without looking. She makes the impossible look easy. But what really makes her so good is that she is the ultimate team player. She makes everyone on her team better. And she's tough. When Griner sustained a cut over one eye during Game 2 against Chicago, Taurasi told her, "You've still got one eye. Get back on the court." And she wasn't joking. That's her warrior mentality. And as a fan who's been there for both of the Mercury's previous two championships, I can say this is the best Phoenix Mercury team ever. They are unstoppable. They will be a dominant sports dynasty for this city. Diana Taurasi could have a championship ring for every finger. This team has single-handedly revolutionized women's basketball. The women's game has always been more of a physical chess match than a brute force display of athleticism. But what makes the Mercury so exciting is they do both. And fans can feel the players' passion. We watch them scream, pump their fists, bump chests. And that fire and personal intensity just ignites the fans in the arena at every game. The Mercury call their fans the X Factor because they bring so much energy to the arena, along with a strong not-in-our-house attitude. When you're in the stands at a Mercury game, you are legion watching legends. You feel mighty. You are in the buzzing, electrical aura of greatness.
Phoenix Magazine managing editor Nikki D'Andrea. The Mercury trying for a series sweep tonight at Chicago, although they might be without star center Brittany Griner. She's recovering from a procedure on her eye.
I want you to know.
When the song You Ought to Know by Alanis Morissette was released in 1995, anyone who'd heard of the singer was probably more familiar with her as a child actor in Canada. But that piece of music and the album it was on, Jagged Little Pill, attracted millions of fans. One of them is Damon Deering of Phoenix's Nearly Naked Theater, which is producing the album project, Jagged Little Pill.
I felt completely inspired and changed by her music. I felt like it was such a personal album. It was so surprising to hear an artist my age singing about such personal things just right there on the radio and with music that I enjoyed. So I own everything she's ever recorded.
Has anyone ever given you a hard time about that?
No. You know, all of my friends were much the same at the time. You know, we were all sort of inspired by that album. And then a lot of the younger kids I work with at the theater, they often, you know, have memories of it because their parents liked it.
Is it a storyline or is it more of a review?
It's a little bit hard to explain because it's kind of both. It does have a concert feel to it. There is no script imposed upon it. It is just an incredible vocal performance. But like an impressionist painting, the songs are kind of interpreted in a way that some people are able to follow a great storyline and some people just let each song tell its own story.
Since this is something so personal to you, are you watching the audience reaction even more closely than you may in another case?
I'm an audience watcher. That's what I do. I want to learn how to affect an audience as best I can as a director. I'm finding myself caught up in the performances a lot more because I love the music so much and these performers are so talented.
For one generation, is You Ought to Know the equivalent of You're So Vain, trying to figure out like who she's talking about?
I think it did have that. I think for a long time because the rumors were swelling so much about who she was talking about. But I think it really much more became the breakup anthem of a generation. Instead of trying to figure out who it is, it's who can I sing this to? You know, who does this mean to me?
And isn't it ironic? Don't you think? It's like rain.
Damon Deering of the Nearly Naked Theater. Its production continues through Sunday. And Mark, before we get to what's going on this weekend,
yes.
Is it ironic?
No. Okay. That's the thing that's so unfortunate about the song. Nothing in it is ironic. It's so annoying. It's a personal pet peeve. Sorry. I'm done now. Some good stuff going on this weekend. You can see The Illusions of Eric Gilliam. He'll be at the Higley Center for the Performing Arts in Gilbert. He's the former, Steve, and I did not know this was a thing, the World Teen Magic Champion.
And Mark, this is not me, but Steve-O will be at the Tempe Improv this weekend. He's the star of one of your favorite programs, MTV's Jackass franchise.
That's true. There's also the Mid-Autumn Chinese Dance Festival on Sunday at the Chandler Center for the Arts.
And Los Lobos will be playing V Cuiva Hotel and Casino tonight.
The show is produced this week by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nick Blumberg, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Kendra Sabo, and Caitlin Stein. Tracy Greer and Maria Springs are our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. We're at the show at KJZZ.org. All Things Considered is next on KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein.
KJZZ is supported by Bank of Arizona, sharing in the vision of strength and stability of the Phoenix business community. Available online at bankofarizona.com. Member FDIC.